Because that's a terrible way to live. When a person like wakes up in the morning and can't look at their own reflection out of fear of what they might see, it's just a very painful existence. And I don't think we need to live that way. But we still stand a better chance of living well if we're able to face ourselves wholesomely, which is a hard thing to do.
I'm David Becker, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker. Welcome to Masters, where I'll talk with leaders in the field of mental health.
One thing we know about the research of what makes therapy work is the therapeutic relationship between therapist and client. That's at the center of it.
Join me as we go behind the scenes and learn how to accomplish personal growth from leading therapists.
We're always weighing what's the pain of living alone in my shame versus the risk of sharing that with another where there might be some judgment. But hopefully we can work through that judgment. But we always need to know that there's no reward in something if it doesn't somehow face some degree of risk. And vulnerability is one of the riskiest things we could do.
Masters of Social Work is brought to you by the Sarah Schneer Wurzweiler Social Work Program. Up close and candid, it can change the way you think. Dr. Akiva Perlman is a clinical director at the ODA Wellness Institute in Brooklyn's Williamsburg neighborhood and a professor and curriculum director at the Wurzweiler School of Social Work in partnership with Sarah Schneer. Since 2007, he's been a psychotherapist in private practice and also a Frum Jew. He's known as a therapist, and he's a highly respected professor. You might say that therapy runs in his family. When Perlman and I recently spoke, I asked him what it's like to have siblings as therapists.
Well, I could go many different like routes on this one. I could go with like the very dark route of the conditions by which a group of therapists are created. And we could talk about that as well, because there's truth in that. It's not only altruism and activism, but the truth is we all grew up in a very active home. I was accustomed to seeing things, hearing things, learning about things that I imagine your average, you know, I went to like Darche, for example, growing up. Your average Darche kid probably wouldn't encounter. On a regular basis, our home was basically open. We didn't call them that at the time, but to the at-risk community. Like I was tutored and to some degree hung out a great deal with people that I know now to be some really embattled souls. But at the time, I didn't really know that about them. They were just older characters that were in my home that needed a place to stay. So my home was always filled with a sense of activism, a sense of mission, a sense of purpose. And that's what was spoken about more than anything else. It was almost like frowned upon for someone to talk about the ideals of money, of success. I don't think money was ever discussed. I think it was just purely about purpose and meaning in the world and making a difference. So we're raised with that message. We live that message. And I think obviously there are other factors as well, you know, that contribute to it. That the fact that the primary person in my life, my mother, who largely raised us, what she valued was activism and purpose and meaning and being a part of the solution. That's what she would speak about. So being raised in that environment, you kind of need to either adapt, but you know, to secure whatever the environment could give you, or you challenge it. And I think most of us really fed into that, to the message that the family, you know, kind of, you know, that my mother sort of passed down to us. It's a wonderful group of people doing beautiful things in the world. Every one of my siblings, even those that aren't therapists, are still one way or another, you know, a part of a solution, trying to bring a little bit more love and compassion into the world.
So what does the family Hanukkah party look like?
It's a drunk person on a couch. When you're family, you're just family, you love each other. And thankfully, you know, many of us, obviously everyone's different, but many of us have really close relationships with one another. We really just honor one another. To me, there's no greater place for me to be than really with like my family and the people that know me on a deeper level, on a personal level, where I could absolutely just be myself in front of. And most of the time when we get together, there isn't all this therapy talk. At all, to be honest. I don't remember the last time there was like a dialogue about therapy. We're all doing different things, and we talk about just regular life. It's a choice that people made to enter into such a profession, but I don't think it defines us.
So that's interesting to me, because there's almost that, you talk about the fusion of personal and professional life, do you find, you know, that there are some therapists who have sort of two personas? They have the professional self, how they act and how they are in the room, and then the personal self. And there are some therapists who it's almost like more what you see is what you get.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject matter. Because on the one hand, all therapists on some level, it's hard to truly be yourself in that space, like fully be yourself. I'd compare it almost to dating. Like when you're dating someone, at least in the beginning, you're really presenting your best self. And you're not bringing in the conflicts, at least in the beginning, hopefully. I'm not sure the number, which date you actually bring in the mess. But I believe there's a certain point you cross over and you're like, now it's time to bring in the other part of myself.
Right.
A client, for example, won't know that you might have just gotten off the phone and are dealing with a personal crisis on the highest level. But then the client walks in and you remind yourself of what's my role in this moment, and you revert back to your best self in order to provide, you know, the healing and a service to some degree to a client, because that's what they deserve. So I think on some level, we're always leaning into the best part of ourselves. But there are definitely approaches to therapy, and I know I'm not sure the crowd fully that we're speaking to right now and how much detail we should go into.
We're speaking to people who know a lot about therapy and people who know nothing. So it's a blend.
Yeah, so we could go into like the very fine details of different ideologies and they're advocating for an emergence of self.
Well, on a global, this is a global question, because I imagine it goes both ways. Meaning that the client is trying to put forth the best version of him or herself, and then the therapist is doing the same. But sometimes people have feedback that they're like, they felt their therapist was too stiff, too formal, too professional, too uncaring, unfeeling, unkind, and maybe it's just more about the money and they don't really care about me. So how do you fight that? Like, how do you bring yourself into the room more?
Yeah, one thing we know about the research of what makes therapy work, at the center of that question is the therapeutic relationship between therapist and client. That's at the center of it. Now, I really believe that no matter what the ideology is, let's say you're practicing a psychodynamic or analytic Freudian approach, which kind of calls for a greater sense of distance. You're not bringing your opinions into the room very much. You're creating a lot of room for the emergence of the client's being to be discovered. I still think even if you're engaged in that type of ideology, there's still a care that could emerge. There's still a sense of humanity that could emerge. And I think when a client says a statement, like, I don't feel like my therapist cares about me, to me, I think that there's a relational struggle that's taking place between the two of them. I don't think it's an ideology. I think that the client, for whatever reason, doesn't feel cared for by that person. And they're probably right on some level. And therapists, I know we don't speak about this as much, but therapists certainly prefer or like certain clients over others. It's something you grapple with, something that you work with. But it could very well be that the feeling that they have is a genuine feeling that they're picking up unconsciously from this therapist that's sort of sending a message of, you know, I'm not fully connected to you right now. So the client feels disconnected in that way.
So if you feel that as a client, you're a little bit stuck.
Well, obviously, the first step would be to try to address it head on. And I think this is something that many, when I speak to clients, you know, I work at ODA and I do many of the intakes there. It's a clinic, a beautiful place, thank God. And the one thing I tell everybody at the end of that intake is I'm going to assign you to a therapist that I think will be the right fit for you. But if it doesn't feel right to you after two or three meetings, let me know. We'll make a change. Because that intuition is often right. And they've actually looked at this, that most clients could sort of tell. But the one thing when I do get that call from people who say, you know, it's not really, it doesn't feel quite right to me for whatever reason, the first thing I'll encourage them to do is speak to their therapist about it. And most of them, sort of, their response is like, I'm allowed to do that. I'm allowed to bring up something or to critique my therapist and say, I'm not feeling cared for by you, or you seem to be dozing off a little bit, whatever it might be, that I'm not feeling nurtured by your presence. And my response is, of course, that the center of therapy is an ability to create a dynamic where you feel comfortable in and you feel like you could fully be yourself in. And I think it's interesting to notice that the therapist is presenting their best self, but we're hoping that we could bring in all of the client's self into the room. Like, we want to create an environment where the client doesn't feel like they need to be anything for us, rather just like they're a wholesome being as much as we possibly can.
It's a big wide world out there. There's thousands of therapists. There are more therapists probably than people at this point. How do you know who's a good therapist? What makes a good therapist? Who should I go to? It feels overwhelming to me. Like, you can go to a therapist and it's just not a shidduch. And then you're starting all over, and here you invested your time, your money, your energy, your emotional self, you were vulnerable, you opened up, and then it just blew up on you. So what's the starting point?
Well, I think thankfully we have a few wonderful organizations that I rely on a great deal, where you speak to them and you say, this is what I'm going through, this is what I believe I need. And it's their job to kind of research the therapist and who's out there. But I think it's a daunting task, and even the idea of like the better therapist out there. Therapists have a certain niche. Therapists have a certain area of expertise or a certain type of person that they work really well with. And I always get surprised, and it always humbles me, where I can meet a therapist and have a really strong negative reaction to what I believe their work to be. And almost always Hashem sort of sends me a messenger a week later where someone comes my way and says, like a client shows up, the greatest therapist ever. And then it always like reminds me, like, settle down, it's okay. And therapists have a strong competitive streak with one another. And most therapists believe that they're better than all other therapists on some level. We need to believe that to sustain our, you know, self and belief in the work that we're doing. But it always humbles me to realize that even every therapist on some level, obviously there's a category of therapists that are, you know, people doing bad things, which thankfully is very, very minimal in our profession because we have checks and balances. We have a training process. We have supervision. We have laws and bylaws and all of that. So it very rarely happens. But aside from that, I think most therapists, the overwhelming majority of therapists, could be really helpful to a group of people, even if another person says, I'm not quite sure they're super helpful.
I can understand someone has a serious problem. You know, they're struggling with OCD, with trauma, with addiction. What about people who are not doing well in life? They don't feel good about themselves. Do they belong in therapy? Should they be in therapy? And how is therapy going to help them?
Yeah, I was just meeting with someone yesterday, really as you just described. She came in for an intake. She said, listen, my husband is in therapy and he's loving it and he's thriving and he's discovering himself. And I'm doing okay. Everything's all right. But I feel like I'm going to be left behind. Like he's engaged in a world that I'm not really familiar with.
Of growth.
Yeah. And her husband, too, he's not dealing with a particular ailment and struggle. He's just trying to enhance his life.
So would you say that our default mode is that we're just maybe going through life, the average person, I'm not talking about someone with a significant struggle, without paying too much attention to themselves and their personal growth. It's just life catches you. And then therapy would be a good idea because it helps you focus inward and grow as a person. Or is life just going to work itself out without it?
Well, look, we have to remember that therapy is a fairly new phenomenon. It's not like it's been around forever. It existed in other forms in earlier times. But we certainly know that it's like best used when there's an identified problem that you're seeking to resolve and seeking to fix. That's for sure. What you're describing, I think, are tend to be the best clients, the ones who are doing okay, but they're not vibrant. They're not living life to its fullest, and they're trying to understand why. They're trying to connect on a deeper level. But it's really a choice that they make. They're choosing to say, I want to engage life in a more vibrant manner, to make it more wholesome for myself. And it's a tremendous thing, but it's really, for those people, it's like a choice. If I want to go, I'll go. If I don't want to go, I don't have to go. I have a few clients now where we're sort of in that place where we're acknowledging in the process that we've gone beyond like the immediate struggle that they were facing that brought them into therapy. And now they're trying to deepen things and they're trying to feel a deeper connection to their children and deal with some of the barriers that exist or a deeper relationship with a spouse. And that's a beautiful form of therapy. That's like a form of like becoming therapy. You know, you have the type of therapy that's about relinquishing pains and struggles. And then you have the, well, who am I really? And how could I best live?
So it's a gift, really.
To a large degree. I think most of those clients would describe it that way.
If you want to give someone a nice wedding gift, six sessions with a good marriage therapist. Hopefully they won't be too insulted.
They probably would be with the gift of therapy. But the cultures that are dealing with a lot of stigma, the only people that will really go are those who have an identified problem and they're trying to find a way to get rid of it. But I always believe that therapy should be a choice. Therapy is a wonderful gift and a wonderful tool. But when it's forced upon a person, then the research on that is just not great at all. It's hard for them to trust. They feel like they're being sent as some form of punishment. So we need to sometimes get creative. Sometimes need to wait. Sometimes you need to set the stage and wait for the right set of circumstances to fall into place for it to work, which introduces some real complicated questions. Like, I see a person suffering. I see a person having a hard time. And they're completely resistant to therapy. Like, what do you do in a situation like that? And I don't think we have many simple solutions to that.
I had someone who, the first thing he said to me was, I'm a non-believer. So I'm like, great, let's talk about that. We got him.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Well, I think, you're human. You're in that space. You're relating. You don't have to, how does that make you feel type of thing?
Yeah. Although it's hard to resist sometimes. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, no, it's a little tick we have as therapists. Yeah. Like, we can't just...
You kind of know it. You know it's coming. You're like, don't do it. Well, how does that make you feel?
It just bursts out. Boom. I got to do this. Yeah, it definitely happens.
And the client is thinking to himself, oh no, he said it again. So that is the question. This is something that I'm grappling with. Maybe you can shed some light on. It seems to me that the biggest fear people have of therapy is judgment. If anyone would know the real me, like the real, real me, not the presentation of me that I share with the world and perhaps even my spouse and perhaps even my close friends, I wouldn't be accepted. Sharing that with a therapist leads to a great fear of maybe the therapist will judge me. Maybe he's judging me. So I have you in this space. Are you judging people?
Judgment is a normal, natural human phenomenon. I don't think it's something that we could overcome. I think that there are ideas that we've been living with for so long. And we're talking about sometimes generations, like it's just intergenerational belief systems, that it's hard not to judge others. And I think it's okay to kind of acknowledge that and say there are certain things that we're going to be a little bit more judgmental of. I think it's the therapist's job to know that, to identify that, and to respond to that, either by... Sometimes, like, the extreme measure would be recusing themselves from the work if there's too much judgment. That's the most extreme reaction. But I think then we have other reactions where the therapist could become aware of what's going on with them. And I think the awareness in and of itself almost always resolves the problem. Like, once you become aware, like, I'm being judgmental. I had this last night. I had a judgmental moment in my day yesterday. I was really disappointed in myself. But I was also in the state of, like, I was activated by it. I was still annoyed at the situation that I was still judging. And I really appreciated coming home and sharing that with my wife. And my wife sort of making one statement of, like, what would it be like to try to view the situation through the eyes of the person that you're judging for a moment? And it was just that awareness. That was it.
And your wife is a therapist as well, right?
My wife is, yes, she's a psychologist. But whether or not she was a therapist, I would hope she would have done the same thing. She was just being present with me. It wasn't like a therapist thing.
Right.
It was just a spouse thing, a caring spouse thing of, like, she saw me angry and frustrated by something and realizing that it probably wasn't the other situation that made me so angry, but probably some of my unresolved stuff that just was activated by this person. And it was helpful. In the moment, obviously, you get, like, defensive and, you want to, like, fight the idea and say, no, really, it's wrong and I should be activated by it. But I think on a deeper level, we kind of know that we're just activated by a belief system or by our own hurts in the past. And that's really was. And I really believe next time I'm in a similar situation, my response will be different. Even internally, my response will be different. Or I hope that that's the case. And if not, we'll keep working at it to get a little bit better. Judgment's a real thing. And I think we need to know that vulnerability, which is so much of what we ask for in therapy, for a client to kind of reveal that part of themselves, that statement you just made is so profound. And I think so many human beings live with that. We just don't talk about it so much. So many people live with some area in their life that's just saturated in shame, where they feel like if anyone were to know this, they'd simply reject me. And in order for that part of a person to be known by any other person, it's going to require a risk. And that risk has the possibility of failure. And if we didn't have that possibility of failure, then it wouldn't be exciting. It wouldn't have the potential for growth in it. So we're always weighing, what's the pain of living alone in my shame versus the risk of sharing that with another where there might be some judgment, but hopefully we can work through that judgment. And that's a real thing to grapple with. But we always need to know that there's no reward in something if it doesn't somehow face some degree of risk. And vulnerability is one of the riskiest things we could do.
In your experience, how does it work for you if a client is vulnerable and says something that maybe is horrifying for you? I did this awful, awful, awful thing. What happens for you in that moment?
Well, the truth is, usually by the time something like that will make its way into the room, because again, the client is also always testing us whether or not we could handle them. There's a rule that a client will only share what they believe their therapist could handle. So you have certain therapists that will never hear about some really intense, dark things because they simply have never created the space for those things to show up in their office. You have plenty of therapists that have never worked with, you know, abuse and trauma on the deeper level because they don't want to see the world that way. They're protecting themselves from the harsh realities, and that's okay that they're doing that. But they also need to know that...
How's it okay?
It's not fully okay. It's okay if they know that, and then they say, okay, I'm going to stick to issues that don't require going to such places. If they don't know that, it's really not okay, because it's kind of their job to create room for those things to emerge. So usually when a client, and I've had plenty of clients share with me that they've, let's say, molested a sibling or even a stranger, and usually by the time that emerges, you really have a sense of who the person is and where they've come from and what could possibly have even caused that. Never to justify it. We don't justify bad behavior at all. Bad behavior is bad behavior. We need to make amends. We need to reach out to the people that we've harmed and take responsibility for it, even if it was at an earlier stage of life where we didn't quite understand. Because when you hurt another human being, you need to take ownership of that. But usually when it does come out, you know the person enough that the compassion that you have for their plight usually allows the judgment to take a back seat. But if you'd hear that on day one, I think that would be a much bigger issue. But most people don't bring that in on day one because they realize that the consequences are going to be quite severe. Listen, all of us on some level, we would feel like if people really knew everything about us, they might be horrified. And I think a lot of us live with that narrative. And I think the beautiful healing power of therapy.
Is that the healing power of therapy? If I can be me, the real me, with my therapist, and my therapist can handle it and is okay, and still has, I guess, a favorable impression of me, then I can be okay as a person in the world.
Well, I think it's a starting point. I don't think that's the end game. Therapists often can get trapped in that and say, well, all you need to do is be genuine here. But to me, the healing takes place in a person's real life. When a person could bring that part of themselves into a marriage, they could bring that into parenthood, they could bring that into a Rebbe Talmud relationship. I think that's when things really begin to shift. Because there is a quality of, this is our job. Our job is to contain that element and those secrets and those burdens. So I think it's still a step removed from reality to some degree. It's the right starting point. I've had clients share things literally 2 years into therapy. It took them that long to feel safe enough. Some shame is so deep that with all the safety in the world, people often will share that I had no intention ever to share this information with anybody. I was going to take it to the grave with me. And the relief they feel that they don't have to do that. Because that's a terrible way to live. When a person wakes up in the morning and can't look at their own reflection out of fear of what they might see, it's just a very painful existence. And I don't think we need to live that way. But we still stand a better chance of living well if we're able to face ourselves wholesomely, which is a hard thing to do.
So you're carrying a lot.
Yes.
How's it going?
It's going beautifully. And I can't tell you the honor I feel every day to carry what I'm carrying. You know, there's certain people, I think they grow up with a narrative of I should be destined to carry certain things. So to me, I'm still quite surprised by the gift I've been given to be able to carry such things. So I'm like deeply grateful for my life on a daily basis, just really grateful for the opportunities I've had. When you hear a lot and you're in charge of a lot and you feel responsible for a lot, then your life becomes very sensitive. And I'm often, you know, carrying a lot of pain with me because the people that I'm honored to hear their stories, like, they stay with me. And I take that as a form of responsibility of what could I do to try to bring some more healing into the world so less people need to feel the way that these individuals do. So there's definitely a burden, there's no question. But the much greater feeling is like just the gratitude. I wouldn't want to live any other life than the one I'm living. I just wouldn't.
I have the great opportunity of working alongside you at the Sarah Schneer-Wurzweiler program. We teach together. We're part of the men's program together. So I'm just curious, what drew you to teaching? What do you like about it? And what does it do for you in a way that therapy doesn't?
I think it was an interesting journey. I think my answer a few years ago would be different than what it is today. I think initially I started teaching. I must have had, it's like hard for me to recall. I started teaching in like the lowest level of Touro College's undergraduate program. It was not at all a part of the Jewish community. It was primarily made up of students who really couldn't get into the traditional programs and needed some remediation and help. And I think I initially started to prove something to myself, that I could, that I was capable. I think it started a lot with me. You know, I always grappled with my self-esteem and my ability to feel capable and intelligent enough. It was always something that, wounds from the past, if you want to call it that. But then as I was deeply surprised, you were that first class that I taught in graduate school.
It was, yeah.
And I can't tell you how shocked I was when I started getting feedback, like that this was something I was good at. It was a complete, it was like euphoric for me, like holy cow. But then once I got over that euphoria and like satisfied the wounds from the past, so to speak, it took a bunch of years, by the way, like to sort of settle into maybe that narrative is not as true as I thought it to be. Then I really started focusing on the mission aspect of it, which is, you know, here I am. I have the opportunity to teach the next like generation of from therapists who are going to be primarily treating our community and our people, which I'm like deeply connected with and passionate about trying to be a part of some type of, you know, hope and growth in that area. And so I don't never take that lightly. Like, it's become much more mission oriented that it has been a feeling of like, I need to do this for myself. At this point, I don't need to do this. I choose to do it because of what it does for me, what it does for the community. And again, it's a beautiful thing that you hear feedback from students that I felt heard by you. You gave us permission to be ourselves. Like, these are things that are wonderful. And I'll get emails all the time from different people in the past, like, you know, I had a session today and your voice was with me as I was like sort of doing things. And, you know, who could ask for something more than just that? It's a deeply humbling experience.
You know, it's interesting. I said recently that our class together, I don't remember much of what you taught. I don't remember much of the content, but I definitely remember a lot of the process. I remember our relationship. I remember the feeling. I remember gaining a little bit of an understanding of what therapy is just from our interactions, more so than what you taught.
Yeah, I have similar experiences with Rabbeim that I've had, like a Rebbe that I'm in touch with on a weekly basis. He's like a part of my life. I was in this class for a year, and I have no idea. I can't even tell you what we learned. I can't tell you what Masechta we were learning that year. But I know I could tell you how I felt in his presence, and that was possibly more important than what we were learning.
Is there a parallel to that in therapy?
100%. Yeah. I've been, let's say, heavily influenced by ideologies that focus more on who you are in therapy than what you do in therapy. Creating space for the emergence of self. And what does that look like? Giving people permission to be their authentic selves. And so the ideas that I've been largely influenced by through Hasidus, through learning psychology, has been that energy, that it's much more about like a flavor than it is about an intervention. So I'm not surprised that like the memory you'll have is more about a flavor than is, because I kind of live that way, right, as best as I can.
If someone wants a Perlman-style therapy, if I'm listening and this is resonating with me, and thinking like, okay, this is the kind of therapy that I want to, maybe I'm ready for now. Where do you go? What's it called? Perlman therapy?
I could tell you like the ideas I've been influenced by and the names that they have. But I'm not sure how much that means. I think, you know, you could describe that I'm looking for an environment to explore myself where it's going to be as much permission lent to me to be my truest form. I think that's how you might describe it. But I've been heavily influenced by, let's say, humanism, which is a form of approach, existentialism, which is another, and also like the psychodynamic theory. I think those three together have had like the main influence on what I do in the room. But I think it's you need a connection with the person that you're with. You need to feel like they truly care about you. And if you don't feel that way, I would bring it up. And if it's not responded to well, I would get out and get to a different place. We're not stuck in therapy, and we could very much challenge a therapist.
I would just say also, really, it's the role of the therapist to bring it out as well. So hopefully, if something's wrong with the relationship, your therapist is going to bring that into the room and say, hey, is something wrong in our relationship?
Yeah, but it takes a very courageous therapist to do that, especially when they're fearful of potentially losing a client, whatever that means to them at that moment. It takes a lot of self-awareness to go in that direction, but hopefully that the therapist you have is one
who possesses... That's the hallmark of an excellent therapist.
Yeah, yeah. One who's humble enough to acknowledge that they're not going to be perfect and right for everybody.
Okay, what percentage of your cases would you say are the ones that you're not perfect and right for? If you don't mind my asking.
No, that's a great question. It's an honest question. If I'd say put everything together, maybe 20% of the people I've worked with, I really felt like I wasn't the right person. And almost always I would bring that up and somehow talk about why I felt that way.
Do you feel like that you're better at bringing that up now than you were initially?
Oh, yeah.
So when going back to where we started, when we talked about the professional persona and the personal persona. So as they blend and merge, and as Dr. Akiva Perlman and Kivi Perlman become one and the same in the room and out, then your comfort level goes up because you're more at peace with yourself and it's okay to not be perfect.
Yeah, I think that the less fractured we are between our professional and personal identities, the more we're able to sort of be okay with our limitations and not feel encumbered by them. I think early on in one's career, any form of rejection is like a monumental moment.
It's awful. Yeah.
It's awful. And we've all experienced it and we'll continue to experience it. It's a terrible feeling. You want to believe that you could do it right by everybody. That's kind of the belief system that you operate with. And
you feel there's your own feeling of failure when you can't be there for someone in the way that they need you to be.
Yeah. And I think that's when we face it head on and acknowledge that we might not be the right fit for that person, the way we see things and the way they see things are just different. Or we make the monumental mistake of trying to become that person for them. And that's when we like sort of break our own rules and boundaries. And I've certainly done that where like I couldn't fully acknowledge to myself that I wasn't the right person. And I tried to become that person. And by becoming that person, yeah, probably ended up hurting people more than helping them.
Wow.
You know, good therapy is when you're most authentically yourself with the client. And if you start becoming somebody else, then you're no longer listening to like an intuitive, you know, self voice. You know, what IFS refers to as like self energy. You're no longer operating with that principle. Rather, you're like in your mind and not as present as you should be.
Let's close with this. What's the Perlman take on from society? Are we moving in the right direction with this? Are people getting help? Are there enough therapists? Is the field flooded? What's next?
Well, I think first we need to, I think it's very easy to criticize individuals, communities, but like to try to not lose sight of the fact that what we have is simply beautiful. You know, just take one step out of what we have to realize that a sense of community, a sense of belonging. There are some workers that are in ODA, let's say from other, you know, immigrants from other countries. And I'm always like asking them how they're doing and how their day is and all that. And I've had the opportunity to hear from some of them. And some of them have like shared, like I've come to this country and I have no one. I don't have those supports, and I often think like it's a moment of hoda and like gratitude, like we're part of a community that no one could say they have no one, really. Meaning there's always something, someone there. I think people feel alone and isolated emotionally, but on an actual practical level, we're surrounded by people that are caring for us. And as a community, I think it would be really hard to find a more beautiful community than ours, period, across the board. And with that being said, obviously we have our work to do. We need to continue to grow and dig deep and to develop and to love more and to include more and to sensitize ourselves to more. So there's always more to do, but we should never lose sight of what we already are. And we're beautiful. We're just a beautiful people. And I think when it comes to therapy, obviously every community is in a different state, but making therapy something that's, you know, with less stigma connected to it, which would open up room for people who are looking just to enhance. But I think overall, we're trending in the right direction. We're trying to get things right. We're trying to understand more. We're trying to help more. And being a part of that movement to bring about positive change is a wonderful thing. And we're all a part of that. Anyone who's aware of the fact that there's hardship in the world, and instead of turning a blind eye to it, is choosing to look at it and ask themselves, what could I do to make this a little bit better? All those people are part of the solution. And it's wonderful. It's an honor to call myself like a part of that group of people that are at least paying attention to that and trying our best. But I think even on the smallest scale, if you simply notice and attempt to do something about it, then you're like every great person that ever existed, one who wants to love a little bit more and to bring a little bit more healing into the world. But there's no question, we have a beautiful, beautiful community. I'm in love.
Dr. Akiva Perlman is clinical director at the ODA Wellness Institute and a professor at the Wurzweiler School of Social Work. Akiva, thanks so much for speaking to me.
Thank you, brother. It's a great honor to be here.
Thanks for listening to Masters of Social Work. Please take a moment to like, subscribe, and share our podcast with your friends. Be sure to follow us for more conversations with leading therapists in the mental health community. I'm David Becker. Masters of Social Work is brought to you by the Sarah Chenier Wurzweiler Social Work Program. For more information, please visit sarahsch.com. That's sarahsch.com. Or call 718-633-8557, extension 37.